So good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another of the MoMA Brown Bag Lunch Lecture Series. We usually do the titles and the topics quite far in advance, several months in advance. And what I wanted to talk about today has, I think, kind of an interesting genesis. And it comes from an occasion that happens quite often here at MoMA. Some of you may know that MoMA is usually available on evenings for various events, private events, corporate events, etc. And one of the interesting situations that I often find myself in is being asked to lecture during these events. Usually there's whatever company or corporation or group is sponsoring it. There might be like a little reception in the main lobby where you can have hors d'oeuvres and a cocktail or two or eight. And then people are invited to go up into the galleries and wander around. And usually lecturers are there not so much to give lectures as to answer questions and things. And of course, one of the things that I like to do is stand in what at MoMA we tend to call the Pollock Room on the fourth floor, because it's a whole gallery filled with paintings by Jackson Pollock. And what's interesting about that and why I like to stand there on these kind of corporate evenings is because I actually like the challenge of having an inebriated investment banker or an accountant come up to me and sort of, you know, demand to know why is this art. This is the big painting, the big 1950 Pollock, which is on the back wall of that room, which I'm sure a lot of you know and have seen, and sort of have to answer these questions, you know, or counter the basic objections that are almost cliched at this point. That's nothing but random squiggles, and, you know, my kid can paint better than this. And my favorite is always, well, how much did you pay for this one? As if I personally bought the Pollock from MoMA, in which case there'd no longer be a need to do brown bag lectures for me or stand around the galleries in the evening or what have you. And what's fascinating about that is even beyond the anecdotal value of these stories, which I think are quite funny in their way, is the fact that many people, even now, even basically a half century after Pollock's death, when he has pretty much universally been enshrined in the canon of modernism, and certainly in the canon of post-World War II American modernism, there is something about Pollock that really still pushes people's buttons, you know, that makes them look at a painting like this and throw up their hands and offer up, you know, some kind of retort. It's often a weirdly angry retort. And my bottom line, and before I summon security and get out my taser, is always to basically say, you know, if you dislike this so much, what are you even doing here in the first place? You know, why are you in these galleries? Why aren't you elsewhere looking at, you know, some form of art that is clearly more suited to your own sensibility? But I think that all that being said, Pollock really does present a kind of challenge to your average museum goer. And part of it has to do with the challenge of looking at abstract art, first of all. We're looking at an art form whose subject matter is not based out in the visible universe that you're used to interacting with on really kind of a daily basis. And I think that part of the problem with Pollock is that he was elevated very quickly to a position of prominence in the American avant-garde, in post-war American modernism. And he was elevated because he had a dealer, Peggy Guggenheim, really kind of looking after and promoting his interests. And he also had a very well-known art critic, Clement Greenberg, who really built, in a sense, a whole kind of school of criticism around specifically Pollock, but perhaps more generally the abstract expressionist movement, what's sometimes called the New York School. And Greenberg went so far as to declare that, well, you know, the idea of trying to reproduce the illusion of three-dimensionality on a two-dimensional surface is ridiculous. Painting, the only true subject matter for painting should be abstraction, because that's what painting does best. It shouldn't be kind of a weak echo of naturalism and what's out there in the world. Painting should do really what it can do. It should take advantage of almost the intrinsic nature of painting itself. And one of the interesting things about Pollock and the way that people react to him, less so on an academic or scholarly level, and more so on the level of, let's say, popular culture, is that Jackson Pollock, of all of these artists involved in the New York School, people like Willem de Kooning and Mark Rothko and Barnett Newman, and I mean, you can sort of, Arshil Gorky, you can name your favorite if you like, Pollock achieved this visibility in popular culture even now, a half century after his death, in the way that most of those other artists have not been able to do. For example, if you think back, if you're a longtime MoMA goer or visitor, MoMA had a retrospective of Pollock's work, I think back around 1997, 98, and it took up basically the entire third floor of at that point, you know, the previous incarnation of the museum before the renovation and expansion. And what I was told by the people who kind of work here and keep track of admissions, statistics, etc., is that more people saw that Pollock show than any exhibition in MoMA's history except for the 1980 big Picasso retrospective, which really was sort of a landmark show in many ways for the museum. And that suggests that people, you know, on many levels have either an interest or, if you like, a vested interest in looking at Pollock, in sort of seeing Pollock's work, and coming to terms with Pollock as an artist in all of these various ways. And, of course, we also know that one of the reasons why Pollock has his place in popular culture is that he died quite young. He died at the age of 44 in 1956. He died either as a result of a car accident. His car ran into a tree on the way back from a little adventure in New York. There are people who think it was basically kind of a suicide and that Pollock may have deliberately crashed his car into a tree. He was very much in the throes of alcoholism and also kind of chronic manic depression. He'd gone on and off his medication for several years, etc. Perhaps was facing a kind of, well, the artist version of writer's block at that time. It's a complicated story at the end of Pollock's life. But there is, no matter how much you try and discourage this among the general public, there's a fascination with artists who die young. And there seems to be, it feeds into that whole kind of cliche of the doomed genius, which, even though we try and shy away from that at this level, there is some weird romantic, with a capital R, attraction to thinking that way about artists, writers, musicians, dancers, what have you. Also, most people know what Pollock looks like. You know, he was very much photographed. Most of you probably know what he looks like toward the end of his life, when he's in his 40s. There was, of course, a Hollywood film made about Pollock, which came out in, again, maybe 1998 or so. It starred Ed Harris as Jackson Pollock. He directed it. Marcia Gay Harden, I think, won an Oscar for her role as Pollock's wife, Lee Krasner. So Pollock is still the only abstract expressionist painter who's had a Hollywood film made about him. I'm not sure if I'd be looking for, like, Leonardo DiCaprio as Mark Rothko anytime soon, but we can keep our fingers crossed and see what happens. And I thought you might like to see a photograph of Pollock in high school. Quite a dashing young man in high school. And in fact, a lot of Pollock's early history, again, is almost part of common knowledge. Many of you know that Pollock actually grew up in the American West, that he was born in Wyoming, that he spent a lot of his, what we might call his formative years in California. His family really moved around a lot as his father changed jobs fairly frequently. And like many good artists did in the 1930s, and for all we know, they still might do now, Pollock arrived in New York because New York was kind of where the art scene was. And he actually took lessons. He took art classes at the venerable old Art Students League, which is only a couple blocks away from here on 57th Street, which some of you may know. And in fact, it's still functioning. You can actually go take life drawing in the same place that Pollock did if you wanted to. Of course, with many people, with an artist like Pollock, and this would be true for somebody like Andy Warhol or Rothko or what have you, most of us, when we think of an artist, we automatically think of one particular type of painting. In other words, we have a kind of visual database already embedded in our consciousness. And I think with somebody like Pollock, the type of painting that most people would think of automatically would be really the sort of late period, what are very often called drip period paintings. And unless you get a chance to see a retrospective like the one that MoMA hosted in the late 90s, you very often don't see a lot of Pollock's early work on museum walls. And I thought it might be interesting for you to take a look at this particular painting. This is a very early painting by Pollock, and it's called Going West. And it's done probably between 1934 and 1938. And this, in fact, most likely reflects very strongly and very directly the influence of Pollock's teacher at the Art Students League, who's the famous American regionalist painter Thomas Hart Benton. And this is actually a work of Benton's from, I think this is about 1934, and it's called Plowing It Under. And there's obviously a marked and very striking similarity between this painting and the one we just saw of Pollock's on the screen. If you know something about Pollock's history and his personality, if you know something about Thomas Hart Benton, it's hard to imagine two figures less likely to really kind of get along in a sort of a classroom or a studio environment. Nonetheless, Pollock clearly learned from Benton, and in some ways emulated or even mimicked his style. But for Pollock, that clearly wasn't enough. Pollock, even though he came from the American West, was now living in New York in the 1930s, was not about to be a sort of Thomas Hart Benton Jr. regionalist painter. And when we look for the marks, quite literally, of Pollock's mature period, when he really starts coming into his own, we tend to look at paintings particularly from the early 1940s. And I wanted to show you a couple of works. These are usually actually hung on either side of the doorway in the Pollock Gallery upstairs on the fourth floor. And this is a painting from about 1942 called Stenographic Figure. And here is where we actually start to see Pollock working out what I think we can accurately call a private language. What I always find interesting about this painting, and obviously what many people see when they look at the painting, of course, there are a whole series of marks that look almost notational or perhaps mathematical or as if they're symbols from some sort of equation or, for example, the language of symbolic logic, if you've ever seen that written out. If you were to subtract all of these things from that painting and you were just to look at what we might call the figure elements here, for example, or perhaps this element here, which looks very much like an arm and a hand, or this part here, I think that most people would say, oh, that looks like Picasso from the 1930s. You know, it looks like the sort of thing that Picasso would have been doing, particularly as he was beginning to emerge from his association with the Surrealists, which lasted for him all through the 20s and 30s. And perhaps that's not surprising in a painting like this, because one of the things that the Abstract Expressionists of the New York School were really trying to crawl out from under were these two gigantic shadows cast on the one hand by Picasso, pretty clearly the most influential artist, I think, of certainly most of the first half of the 20th century, and second, from out from underneath, a giant shadow cast by European Surrealism, particularly because a lot of the European Surrealists, with the rise of National Socialism, with the changing political climate in Europe, with the outbreak of World War II, with the fall of France, etc., a lot of those artists emigrated to the United States, and where they came was New York. So New York was almost like a walking, living, breathing laboratory of European Surrealism. And it's not surprising that a kind of coming-of-age artist like Pollock, and for that matter some of the other Abstract Expressionists, really worked their way through these various phases. There's a very lovely, but rather uncharacteristic, Mark Rothko upstairs in the first gallery, which seems derived completely from the vocabulary of European Surrealism. And it's before Rothko ever gets to his mature phase of his beautiful and very soothing, hovering, intensely colored rectangles that I'm sure you're all familiar with. And if you look at a painting like this, or its corollary painting, which is usually directly across the doorway from it on the other side, this is a painting that Pollock did in 1943, and it's called She-Wolf. And of course, this is not nearly as difficult to look at, to understand, to parse, if you like, as some of Pollock's later purely abstract works, which tend to often be called untitled or simply be given numbers in their title. Pollock titles this She-Wolf, and you know your job is to find the She-Wolf in the painting. And it's actually fairly easy to do, because pretty clearly the head is here, the forelegs, the body of the wolf, the hind legs, etc., the udders of the she-wolf. It's a mother wolf, if that's actually the correct term for the appendages of the mother wolf in this case. And if you're wondering where the subject matter came from here, basically Pollock and a lot of the other New York School painters had quite an interest in things like mythology, mythological archetypes. They were quite interested in psychology, not so much Freud, whose theories were already beginning to fall out of favor in the 30s and 40s, but the work particularly of Jung and his idea of mythological archetypes, etc. And a lot of you would probably, particularly if you know your ancient history and you know your ancient art, this is modeled on probably a photograph that Pollock saw of a very famous Etruscan bronze sculpture, which is now in the Capitoline Museum in Rome. It's that museum right at the top of the Roman Forum. A bronze wolf which has two little baby boys suckling from the teats of the wolf. Those two little baby boys were actually added in the 15th or 16th century, so those are Renaissance editions. And that was to connect it up with one of the ideas about the founding of Rome. Supposedly Rome was founded by Romulus and Remus, his twin brother, who'd been abandoned in the wild by their parents, who were adopted and suckled by a wolf who lost her cubs, etc. This is really one of like the archetypal foundation stories for Rome. And what I would usually suggest or argue is happening here is that, first of all, this is not an abstract painting, because Pollock has not, in fact, removed himself from the world of representational subject matter yet. But all of these various marks and all of these various almost calligraphic or hieroglyphic symbols that make up much of the surface of the painting, and that are in some cases imposed or overlaid on top of the subject matter itself, that's Pollock basically working out the parameters of his private language. It's almost as if on this painting, in Stenographic Figure that we were looking at just before, you really have Pollock essentially determining what the grammar and the syntax of his painted expressive language is going to be. And the more he gets involved in that, the less connected, the less attracted he is to representational subject matter, which, again, as a lot of you know, is going to basically flee from his paintings altogether by about 1947, 1948. That, for Pollock, in many ways, that's the great break. That's where he becomes essentially a purely abstract painter. And that is where, particularly if you're doing a little chronological survey of the paintings on view here at MoMA, you eventually wind up at this particular painting, which is sometimes called One. It's often called Number 31, 1950, because many of Pollock's abstract works were either untitled or simply numbered in sequence for the most part. And this is the biggest Pollock in MoMA's collection. It's really given pride of place in the gallery upstairs. It takes up the entire back wall of that Pollock gallery or Pollock room on the fourth floor. And of course, it is a bit of a conundrum. If you are not used to looking at abstract art, if you are used to keying your responses to something identifiable that you can see, the problem here is essentially the problem in figuring out what you're looking at. And then the secondary problem is figuring out how you're supposed to see and think about what's on the surface of this particular canvas. And there are ways in to a painting like this. The way that I sometimes explain this in gallery talks upstairs, or to inebriated investment bankers, is that there is no front door to this painting. You actually have to approach it from a variety of side doors. In other words, you can't really talk about the subject matter because, as I'll try and convince you, the subject matter is, in a sense, literally unspeakable. That is, we can't really talk about it because the language isn't there, in a sense, to talk about it. And I would argue that one of the things a painting like this is about, certainly not the only thing, one of the foremost things a painting like this is about is process, is the act of painting itself. You know, we know how Pollock made this work. And in fact, when you look at this work upstairs, and then if you spend a little bit of time and you move a little bit closer, and you look at some of the details, you can actually figure out how the work was made. You know, you can understand that there are all different layers. There are these sort of webs or networks of paint on the surface of the canvas. And in a detail like this, you can understand that you can see the texture of the canvas itself through some of the thinner, more transparent layers of paint. You can see that some of the layers, for instance, the white layer that we see on the screen now, was obviously added afterwards. You can see how the layers are built up. It's not really a mystery. It simply requires paying a little bit of attention. And fortunately, when we talk about Pollock and we talk about process, his process is quite well documented. There are a number of very famous paintings, or rather photographs, of Pollock at work making a series of paintings. This one gets reproduced very often, for example, in catalogs and books about Pollock. And we understand that he didn't paint in a traditional way. We understand that he took these pieces of primed, rather unprimed and unframed and unstretched canvas and put them on the floor of what sometimes people call the barn of his property, where he lived with Lee Krasner in the Springs, in the Hamptons. It's really not so much a barn as like a big tool shed in some ways. And Pollock would quite literally almost stalk the canvas before he began applying paint. And he would apply paint by pouring it, by dripping it, by spattering it, by flinging it across the surface. He would do almost everything except take his brush, charge it up with pigment from his palette, and apply brush strokes. In many of Pollock's later works, but not all of them, there isn't really much of a brush stroke to talk about anymore, because in some of them there's not really much of a brush that was used to make them in the first place. Now, there is a very well-known documentary filmmaker and photographer, Hans Nemeth, who in fact photographed Pollock at work, made a documentary film of Pollock painting, where you really see the process and you can see the paint accrete almost layer by layer. And these are two of the photographs that Namath took in the early 1950s. These are actually published in a big article in Life magazine, where the cover actually asked, you know, is this the future of American painting? It was clear that in the early 50s, a lot of people were really divided about that. And what's interesting about this is, first of all, you see Pollock at work in his tool shed-like space. That is his wife, Lee Krasner, who was seated on a stool. It almost looks like a throne, and she's sort of supervising the work here. And the painting that Pollock is photograph making here is the one that's up in the gallery on the fourth floor. So this is one number 31, 1950. Pollock is, and we very often look at this photograph to sort of see some of the layers that you might not see quite as easily in the work upstairs. And of course, it's fairly easy and in some ways, I think, fairly obvious to really talk about how Pollock makes his works, etc. One of the interesting things that you sometimes find is that you can explain Pollock's process, and that someone who already finds themselves kind of set against Pollock or who doesn't appreciate or understand the work is going to say, fine, I understand how the painting was made. It still is all kind of random squiggles on the surface of the canvas. You know, Pollock doesn't really know where that paint's going to land. He's just flinging it across there, and that's it. You know, so why is this still a work of art? Why are we talking about it in these terms, etc.? And of course, what I would argue there, or just even point out, is that it's not all random squiggles, but certainly there is, in fact, an element of randomness in Pollock's work. And that's really part of the point. You know, if you're going to charge up your mixing stick with paint and fling it across the surface, you're going to somewhat control where that paint lands. But you are also basically surrendering to the forces of gravity and, for example, to just the forces of physics. Momentum, etc., velocity, the weight of the paint, etc. All of these things are going to partly determine where that paint lands on the canvas and how it lands. And Pollock is very, very interested in that. And the reason why he's so interested in that is because that process allows you to really kind of unyoke yourself from the very tight control that painters, at least in theory, have had over painting for the last 25,000 years of painting history. In other words, if you go all the way back to prehistoric cave paintings from the Paleolithic period, people have been painting essentially the same way, with this idea of fairly precise control over where that paint is going to go. And Pollock and the Abstract Expressionists, and I mean other artists in the 20th century in general, are sort of asking this question, are there not other ways to do this? You know, can we not sort of move away from conventional styles? I mean, in a lot of ways, the Surrealists in Europe in the 20s, particularly in Paris, were asking the same questions. How do we kind of react against, how do we respond to the conventions of what in Surrealism was sort of bourgeois middle-class painting, basically. And they took it in a different way. They removed painting from the realm of the logical and sort of veered toward the illogic, toward what you might call the logic of dreams in many ways. And Pollock and the Abstract Expressionists are taking another direction. They are loosening their own control on the process of painting itself. You can understand all of that, and you can understand that Pollock's not the only painter doing this, but I think to really think about why it is he's so interested in this and how this comes about. In part, it means reconstructing the kind of popular culture in which Pollock lived. And that, in other words, we want to know, like, well, what was Pollock talking about? What was he reading? What was he thinking about? What were he and his friends talking about at the Cedar Tavern, you know, where they usually met for conversation and drinks and then more drinks and then more drinks after that? And that turns out to be actually quite difficult to reconstruct. Even though it's only half a century ago, there are what you might think of as Pollock's day-to-day component of popular culture is quite difficult to rebuild. You almost have to be an archaeologist to do that. And so you can imagine how difficult it would be to think about trying to do that for somebody like Michelangelo 500 years ago, or you know, an anonymous Greek painter 2,000 years ago. That much being said, you can place Pollock in the context of other things that are happening in the late 40s and early 50s. There are other people who are interested in using elements of chance to determine the way things happen in not just a work of art, but sometimes a work of literature, you know, a piece of writing, certainly a piece of music, etc. And if you step back a little bit from what Pollock's doing, you think about this kind of grander culture of the use of chance and the elements of chance and randomness, you begin to see that what Pollock is doing is certainly still relatively revolutionary, but it's very much connected up to the culture of the avant-garde at the time. One of the first places that we often think about this and sort of talk about it in some ways is to kind of talk about music. And it's fairly well known. So this is, we're just going back to the overall view of Pollock's 1, number 31, 1950 here. It's fairly well known that Pollock listened to jazz, that he liked to listen to jazz while he worked. And if you don't know anything beyond that, at first you get very excited because you think, okay, early 1950s, well, that's when jazz is starting to kind of move away from chord structures, from traditional melodies and patterns. And immediately you start thinking, well, it's bebop, it's Charlie Parker. And you might think, well, Ornette Coleman is just around the corner, and free jazz. In fact, that's not what Pollock actually listened to at all. This is where you have to be slightly careful, because Pollock's favorite jazz composer and jazz artist was Duke Ellington. Ellington is not someone who is very interested in free jazz. He's still very much in that kind of tightly controlled, very sophisticated compositions, you know, from what you might call the swing era of jazz. So if you're looking for a kind of musical analog to Pollock, the jazz that he liked to listen to is probably not the answer. I would suggest you have to go a little bit further afield, and you have to look at what's happening in what we might call avant-garde composition, if you like avant-garde classical music. And in fact, we have to look at somebody like John Cage, who was in New York at the time. Cage, of course, is a real polymath. He was interested in experimental writing. He produced numerous experimental narratives, a lot of poetry. He also was a visual artist in his own right, and he's sort of best known. He's come down to us, I think, in the manner that most of us think of him, as a musical composer. And a lot of various interesting avant-garde, sometimes controversial works, like his piece, which is just basically 5 minutes of silence, etc. And jazz, Cage was also known as an authority on mushrooms and macrobiotic cooking, which is something you might not know quite as much about. And this is a relatively early photograph of Cage in the 1950s. Cage and Pollock didn't really connect. They didn't quite move in the same circles. It's known that Cage didn't particularly like Pollock. He understood abstract expressionism, but he thought that the world of the abstract expressionists in the New York school was really, you know, sort of based on a lot of like macho, straight male values, et cetera, which were not particularly avant-garde unto themselves. What Cage was interested in a lot of his own work, was to use elements of chance in musical composition. And the system that Cage preferred most often was the ancient Chinese system, the I Ching, which is where you use coins and you throw the coins to determine the order of events in whatever it is you happen to be working on. Now, I did this. I just pulled this image off the internet, like everybody does these days, certainly like all my students do, to show you what these I Ching coins look like. And these apparently are for sale, so you can go to that website and buy them if you like. These are I Ching coins used to determine kind of feng shui, the placement in a house and objects in a house, etc. And Cage would often use coins like this, for example, to determine the order of arrangements in a musical piece. Most notoriously, and I don't have, unfortunately, a sound clip of this piece, one of the things that Cage once did was to take basically star charts of the positions of stars and constellations in the night sky. He would poke a hole in that chart where each star was. He would shine light through that down onto musically notated paper below, onto, you know, page with staffs, etc. And wherever the light from a star would come through, he would fill in a note. And then somebody, I don't know if it was Cage or not, would play that. And if you ever hear that, or if you ever hear a lot of Cage's kind of chance or random generated pieces, it's not going to sound like music to you at first, because you are very not used to hearing that sort of music. You're used to hearing linear progressions. I mean, most of us kind of understand the rudimentary principles of harmony and composition and melodies and things like that. All of that goes completely when you listen to a piece by Cage. In a way, you almost have to retrain your ears to hear it as music. Much the same way, I'd argue, you almost have to retrain your eyes to see Pollock if you're so used to looking at either non-abstract works or works that are not from the New York School or the Abstract Expressionists, etc. And just to give you some idea of what the method that Cage used. I want to play just a brief clip of a piece by him. This is Cage reading and sort of taking pieces of Henry David Thoreau's journal and rearranging them using the I Ching. And he'll even say this right at the beginning. And you'll sort of hear the way what sounds like a linear narrative text is in fact not a linear narrative text at all.
This is called Song. It was derived from the journal of Henry David Thoreau by means of I Ching chance operations. Wasps are building summer squashes. Saw a fishhawk when I hear this. Both bushes and trees are thinly leaved. Few ripe ones on sandy banks. Rose right up high into the air, like trick of some pleasant demon to entertain me, and birds are heard singing from far. Burst like a stream, making a world, how large do you think it is, and how far? To my surprise, one answered, 3 rods. Begin to change. In the woods, we came upon a partridge. I find myself covered with green and winged lice. When I look further, I find the lower streets of the towns. In a few weeks, they will be as it should be. Government, snake, and toad, an August wind, soaring hawks, dog of the woods, open the painted tortoise nest.
So that gives you some idea of how I think Cage's technique works as a process and how it sort of sounds in real time. Those are real pieces. Those are real pieces of Thoreau's very narrative journals. And they've sort of been rearranged according to this method of throwing these coins into essentially a new kind of text, which doesn't have the same syntax, which doesn't have the same meaning anymore. And of course, one other place to look for analogs to, I think, what Pollock and some of the other abstract expressionist painters were doing is if you look to a lot of avant-garde literature of the 1950s, particularly if you look to something like what we call the Beat Movement. So if you were to read, for example, poetry by Allen Ginsberg or Jack Kerouac is one of the best-known figures. You know, you might think On the Road and this kind of long, spontaneous narrative creation of things like that. Of course, a lot of that stuff also happens later in the 50s. On the Road doesn't come out until after Pollock is dead for several years. And the writer that I think, in some ways, Pollock is most analogous to, although, again, there's not much of a personal connection there, is our friend William Burroughs, who we have pictured on the screen here with one of his favorite toys. He's very often photographed with guns, of course. And Burroughs is a kind of, or was, the author of notorious books like Naked Lunch and The Wild Boys and The Soft Machine and Cities of the Red Night, and a whole series of texts whereby he actually used a method that he called the cut-up method. And Burroughs would often type out a perfectly linear narrative text, and some of his books are more linear than others, and he would then literally cut up sentences or paragraphs or even phrases, sometimes individual words, and scramble them on the desktop and then retype the result in the order in which they kind of arrange themselves on the desk. And if you read a passage from one of these more obviously cut up Burroughs novels, and by the way, if you read a Burroughs novel, you kind of have to do it when you're sort of like still in your 20s or so. If you wait too long, it's not going to work for you for the most part. Just that's like a public service warning there. What you find when you read these texts is that they, too, do not have a kind of standard linear structure where event A does not lead to event B, does not lead to event C, etc. And I thought I would just read to you a brief passage from, this is Burroughs' book, The Wild Boys, with its original collector's cover on the left-hand side here. This is from a chapter called The Penny Arcade Peep Show, and there are a whole series of these interjections in the book. He wasn't there, really. Pale, the picture was pale. I could see through him. In life, used address I give you for that belated morning. Young ghosts, blurred faces, boys in workshops, the old February 5th, 1914. I am not a person and I am not an animal. There is something I am here for, something I have to do before I can go. The dead around like bird calls rain in my face. Flight of geese across a gleaming empty sky. Peter John S., 1882 to 1904. The death of a child long ago, cool remote spirit to his world of shades. I was waiting there, pale character in someone else's writing, breathing old pulp magazines. Turn your face a little to eyes like forget-me-nots. Flickering silver smile melted into air. The boy did not speak again. So, although in some ways this is sort of recognizable as a narrative text, it in fact is made by cutting up a standard narrative text and resequencing the pieces. And Burroughs did this in many of his books, particularly his later books. He also was quite interested, although Burroughs himself was not really, I think, what we would consider a visual artist. He was quite interested in this whole idea of the cut-up technique and sound as well. And I'm going to play for you just a brief fragment of one of his quite early sound cut-up collages, which dates to about, I think this one's usually dated to 1951 or 1952.
Oh, up in the lake.
How to do it?
Your poor turn, Billy.
Poor
turn, Billy.
The steel.
I'm easing down.
Yawning.
The steel.
The beginning.
There was no
yawning, Will.
I'm easing.
Yawning.
The steel.
I'm easing.
Your
tree.
And the
tree.
And the
hill bound
and tree.
Your tree.
And Billy.
Well.
In the desolate moth.
There was no
yawning.
The steel.
I'm easing.
Your tree.
And the
tree.
And the
hill bound
and
yawning.
The dungeon and
yawning.
Well,
smell of late more
bill bound
and
yawning.
I think there, of course, you realize that the language is sort of transformed into like a new language altogether. And the sound of the cut-up itself, the sound of the fragments of the tapes being joined, this is still back in the analog age. We all live in the digital age of sound now, of course. And what you're really hearing there is essentially the birth of a new kind of expressive language for somebody like Burroughs. When we come back to this Pollock painting, and again, we're sort of focusing on number 31, 1950, if you really apply some of the things that we've been talking about, I mean, there are always going to be people who are going to look at this painting and they're going to say, all right, I get the thing about process. I understand, you know, what you said about Cage and Burroughs and chance and all these other things. I still want to know what the subject matter is here, you know, what the meaning of the painting is. And the problem there is that you don't really, or you can't, in a way, look at abstract painting, certainly abstract expressionist painting, really in the same way. And we might make another analogy here to a kind of an artistic cliche that I'm sure you've heard before. If you've gone to, let's say, an exhibition where the artist is present, either local or a gallery or something like that, and someone asks the artist to explain their work, and they say, well, I prefer to let the work speak for itself. Now, you know that when somebody says that, the red light immediately goes off in your head, and that means that the artist you're dealing with has absolutely no idea how to sort of think about, talk about, speak about their work, etc. You know, so it is a bit of a cliche, I think. In Pollock's case, though, it's almost literally true, if he were to say that, because in many ways, one way to think about a work like this that's on the screen now is to understand that if Pollock could tell you what he was doing in this painting, if he could describe his intent, if he could write it down or speak it in conventional language, then he wouldn't actually have to paint it anymore. Because then, let us say, spoken or conventional written language would be sufficient or adequate, but it's not. So he has to resort to another form of language altogether. In his case, the very particular and very personal form of gesture and chance that evolves onto the surface of this particular canvas. One of the things that has always frustrated, again, more casual museum goers is that it seems as if abstract expressionist painting is designed to be literally inscrutable and somewhat unspeakable, at least in terms of its subject matter. It seems to resist standard visual analysis. And this seems to be something that the abstract expressionist painters wanted. They deliberately wanted the subject matter to be way up here in the ether somewhere so that, you know, normal language couldn't even really comprehend it. It's weird to think about visual artists making art that is deliberately incomprehensible because it seems to really kind of belie what we think about in just the pure communication between a visual artist having something to present or something to say or what have you and you, the viewer. Pollock would often say, he didn't say much, by the way, he wrote almost nothing about his works. He preferred not to be interviewed, not to speak about it. But Pollock would often say that the viewer completes the painting, the viewer completes the picture. What you bring to the painting is sort of the final stage, in a way. And there are those art historians who will sometimes, I guess, crumble to pressure and say, all right, well, maybe what we're looking at here is sort of an analog to, let's say, motion at the atomic level. That Pollock is painting this in 1950. It's the beginning of the atomic age. The first A-bombs were detonated 5 years ago. You're about, I think, maybe 3 years away from the hydrogen bomb. The Cold War has begun. People are talking about nuclear energy. Maybe this is what orbitals sort of look like, or electrons look like as they orbit their nuclei at the atomic level, something we can't even see with the naked eye because it falls outside the spectrum of visible light. Pollock would never actually come out right and say that. There are people who speculate or extrapolate that he's living in the early atomic age and maybe somehow this is making its way into his unconscious. I don't know whether to tell you to believe that or not, because it's very hard to come up with specific evidence for that one way or the other. I think that, you know, it's sort of undeniable that a painting like this is also partly about energy, though. If you stand in front of this Pollock upstairs for more than a few seconds, and one of the really curious things, many museums, of course, have commissioned surveys that let us know that the average visitor spends about 5 seconds in front of a painting before moving on to the next one. You can't, in most cases, possibly draw out everything that's in a painting in a quick 5 second glance. And I can report to you that if you stand in front of this Pollock for 20 minutes, and I've done it, this is my Marina Abramovich thing, I've stood in front of this Pollock painting for 45 minutes one time. This is the only thing I looked at. And a lot of the energy there really does translate to you, you know, and you can almost feel yourself start to, there's some sort of internal quivering going on in your sensibility. I don't know if it's really physical or not, but it felt like, you know, going to the cafe on the fifth floor and drinking 5 of their incredible hot chocolates in a row or something, where you're just sort of shaking with everything that's going on there. I've always thought strategically that's why there's a Mark Rothko in the next room, because that's where you go. If you're sort of in, you know, if you used to go to raves and things in the 90s, and I know there are some of you out there, the next room with the Rothko is the chill-out room, basically, where you just kind of come back down to earth. And it's interesting, too, that what we might consider, like, not quite the next generation of artists, but artists who are younger than the abstract expressionists, people like Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns in the 1950s, and then even a little bit later, somebody like Warhol working in the late 50s and 60s, they reacted very viscerally to this perceived high-mindedness of abstract expressionism. And they took the subject matter of painting and yanked it right back down to the ground. So you have Rauschenberg literally painting the bed that he slept in. You have Johns and his American flag paintings. You have Warhol elevating the Campbell's soup can to the level of high art, you know, choosing this very banal and commercial object and making art about that. In a way, it's a sort of reaction against the high-mindedness of abstract expressionism, which had been triumphed as the major form of American painting, and by extension, at least if you believe Clement Greenberg, the major form of painting, period, in the post-war period. So all of these things, I mean, what we've really done is just try and evoke a series of strategies for looking at Pollock, dealing with Pollock, maybe not so much, I think, loving Pollock. That's totally up to you and your own sensibility, however that formed. But the point here was to kind of show you these different ways into a painting, to connect it up with the context of popular culture, and hopefully to rush up to the fourth floor gallery now, or at least in a minute or two, and feel like you maybe understand Pollock a little bit better. And understanding is very often the first step to a kind of an aesthetic appreciation of something. So if all of that worked today, then it's sort of mission accomplished, and I will be a very happy lecturer. So let me thank you very much for your time and attention today. We have time maybe for a brief question or two. Yes, in the front row here. I think you had your hand up first.
I King.
It's the ancient Chinese system of chance operations based on the throwing of coins.
Sometimes called I Ching.
Yeah, it depends on which pronunciation system you want to use. Two words, capital I and then capital C-H-I-N-G.
But it has to do with coins,
right,
of which some of that...
It's like throwing a coin and figuring out whether it lands heads or tails. I mean, in some ways, we still determine the order of events, like who gets to receive first in a football game as a coin toss.
And what happens with that? What does he do with that? How does he...
Well, let's say you have a decision. This is sort of a question about how does that enter into Cage's psyche. I think it's better to look at it in more practical terms. You have a decision. You're writing a melody. You don't know whether your next note should be a third higher or a fifth lower. So you throw coins and you decide, all right, heads, it's a third higher. Tails, it's a fifth lower. It does. I mean, and there are contemporary artists. The recording artist Brian Eno devised a whole strategy in the 1970s, which he called oblique strategies, to sort of determine. It's a way of solving conundrums when you're in the midst of composing something, one way or the other. Yes.
Pollock was classically trained. I'm going to assume that Cage was classically trained in something. Burroughs was classically trained in something. My question is, can you go to that level of creation if you're not classically trained?
That's sort of a good question. It's sort of a remark about Pollock obviously had, in fact, fairly traditional artistic training. Cage, we know, had fairly traditional compositional. I mean, you first have to learn to read music. You have to learn to know what the notes are. In Pollock's case, I mean, he did take life drawing. He did take sort of compositional studies, etc. Burroughs, I'm a little less sure about. I'm not sure if he didn't get an MFA in creative writing. We know that. I think what the interesting question is, not so much, you know, can you do this sort of stuff if you don't have that training? It's what makes you leave that training behind in the first place. I mean, for me, the question about abstract art is, first of all, why is it a 20th century phenomenon? How come we don't have it earlier? You know, what is it about the conditions of modern life that allow, let's say, Kandinsky to paint the first abstract painting in 1910? That's actually the subject of another brown bag lunch lecture, of course. But I think on a, you know, just on a more aesthetic level, I always wonder, what is it that makes an artist sort of depart entirely from the representational world? I mean, you have two of the best-known prolific artists in the 20th century, Pablo Picasso and Henri Matisse, and between them, neither one of them ever painted a single abstract work. For them, the representational world, the visible universe out there, was so rich and so infinite, there was no need to depart from it. And yet, you have Kandinsky, you have Pollock, you have all the other abstract expressionists, you have some, like, snotty artist coming out of SVA who's just graduated and is going to depart from the real world and become an abstract painter for the rest of his probably very brief career. You know, that process to me is fascinating. And not only that, but every artist who does work abstractly, every artist arrives at abstraction via a different pathway. MoMA really lets you see this very well, particularly in the case of a gallery on the fifth floor. It's a whole room full of works by the Dutch artist Piet Mondrian. You can follow Mondrian's way of thinking from his kind of representational beginnings to his development of cubism in Paris, to his eventual reduction of everything to grids with primary colors. You can see that whole thing just in one room upstairs. Yes?
Is it possible that the voyage from faith to reason to the Enlightenment to chaos and randomness to the death of God, to the sense that in the 20th century the unexpected always happened, not predictable anymore. I will tell you that I've looked at this, and your colleague John Angeline was a wonderful teacher, but I've looked at this so much, and on 9/11, the TV camera caught an instant of jumbled wires of all the computers, and that destruction and that moment of intense energy and terror, brought me right back to Pollock. And I thought, the challenge for an artist who says, I will not show a recognizable object, might be, this is my own hunch, I will depict an almost unacknowledged emotional state, terror, fear.
Sure. This is sort of a comment about, you know, the connection between abstract painting. I mean, I'm just going to telescope your remarks to emotional states. Kandinsky would agree with you, and he's what we think of as the first abstract painter. I mean, I think, you know, one way of looking at this, and you're very right, there's something about the 20th century. It's World War I, some people would argue, which is a kind of unprecedented destruction, even though now to us it seems like some historical war way back early on. I mean, I've always argued that in purely visual terms, what changes painters most about the subject matter they present and how they present it is actually photography. and the growing popularity, availability, and eventual ubiquity of photography in the 20th century, where suddenly the camera does what painters have been supposed to do, and it does it much better in terms of realism and representation. So if you're a painter, like, what are you going to do? You know, the camera has come along, it's literally usurped your place. And maybe Kandinsky's answer was to take painting to a place where the camera can't go, you know, which in his case was the subconscious, the unconscious mind. Sure, but you need Freud to be able to tell you that there's a subconscious or unconscious mind in the first place. So every time you start thinking of the answer, it just keeps getting wider and wider and wider. But I think these are all good ways of thinking about abstraction in general, Pollock specifically. And to me, I mean, I've lectured about this painting for something like 10 years now, and same thing with Kandinsky. I never get tired of looking at it. And I think, as I've made clear today, I also never get tired of explaining it to people who don't necessarily see it or, in some cases, who hate it. And it's also fun with inebriated people, so, you know, I never get tired of that either in some ways. So thank you very much again for your time and attention today. Enjoy the rest of the day at the museum.